Okay, welcome back. So I hope you guys found the test to be straightforward. Okay, so we will probably have the test graded within a week or so. So in this class, it's going to be slightly shortened class because we're starting it around 7:35. So we'll finish on time again at 8:50. Okay, to get started off, we left the last class when we were looking at ATM concepts, particularly the idea of statistical multiplexing. Okay, so to recap, ATM is a curious mix of both telephony concepts as well as packet switching concepts. Okay, so it retains the notion of signaling, okay, primarily because it allows it to pin a path down and use smaller labels in its header. Okay, that's number one. And the number two reason is that once you pin a path, you can also associate resources with the path optionally. Okay, you don't need to associate resources like telephony for every virtual circuit, but ATM allows you to do that. And what's interesting is that you can reserve different kinds of resources. You can reserve resources that can give you your session a kind of delay guarantee. Sometimes it can give you a bandwidth guarantee or some mix of the two. Or it could give you just an expectation of some bandwidth guarantee or delay guarantee. So these are known as statistical guarantees. Okay, so in other words, ATM gives you a lot of flexibility to decide exactly what kind of resources you want to reserve. Okay, so the signaling concept was still held on to. Okay, ATM uses fixed size and small cells, which allows you to build higher speed switches. Okay, so that was a fundamental innovation at that time. Okay, later it became apparent that with the progress of technology, you could build high-speed switches and routers even without the notion of fixed size. Okay, but even till today, a lot of internal IP routers do have ATM switches or fixed-size switching in its internals. Okay, so we'll study switching much more detail when we go on. Okay, so right now, so with that quick update, we are coming back to this notion of statistical multiplexing. As I mentioned, the whole goal is to reserve something, but if you're not using it, give it to others who are available, okay, a lower priority or lower QoS type sessions which are available. Okay, and usually, if I just have a single FIFO queue, there is some kind of a trade-off always if you do statistical multiplexing. It means delay or packet loss. Okay, but ATM allows you to distribute the delay and packet loss among sessions. Okay, you can have premier sessions which do not face delay or packet loss, or do not face some combination of them, but then lower priority sessions which can face delay or packet loss if traffic shows up. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Okay, and again, this is a picture from one of the earlier slide sets. We'll look at quality of service in more great detail later in the class, but essentially ATM is an example of how quality of services is implemented. It has a natural control plane activities with setup circuits, which is primarily signaling, and setup resources for that circuit, which is typically known as admission control, and in the IP context, sometimes it's known as contracting or service level agreements. Okay, and it provides facilities to do provisioning and traffic engineering. These are less obvious things, but it's essentially it's like reserving resources in terms of routes and for larger trunks of traffic rather than for on a single route you can reserve resources at particular bottlenecks. Okay, so traffic engineering usually deals with reserving routes, etc. Okay, or mapping traffic to particular routes. So these are all control plane activities, and ATM provides you some sort of a hook or a handle to do these things. Okay, similarly in the data plane you have a concept of an edge node, which does shaping, policing, and marking, etc., and core nodes or core switches, which provide scheduling and buffer management, which are essentially methods of assigning quality of service when packets show up. Okay, again, we'll study these in much more greater detail, but we'll overview some of the key ideas in ATM. Okay, so in terms of the services, okay, at the end of the day, what you get are services from ATM. Okay, so services are categorized into five categories. Primarily, there are these are known as ABR, UBR, CBR, VBR, and there's one more which are not listed here, known as GFR. Okay, GFR stands for Guaranteed Frame Rate. I don't know why I didn't put it here. So let's take a look at what these are. Okay, so probably simplest is CBR. CBR simply stands for a constant bit rate, which is as close as you can get to a telephone line. Okay, so it's pretty much a telephone line. But the only difference is that you can define a CBR for other rates as well, not just 64 kilobits per second or just products of them. You can define a CBR for 10 kilobits per second, for example. Okay, so so these other, in addition to rate, bit rate, you also have bounds on what will happen to your delay or what will happen to delay variation, so which is also important in telephony, right? If you just get throughput on the average, but your delay keeps varying all the time, your telephone calls will lose synchrony, okay, at the edges of the ATM network. Okay, but you could regain synchrony by doing other fancy things like they do in today's IP telephony world, which we'll discuss later. But CBR essentially gives you a very simple abstraction where you can just map telephone calls or trunks like T1, etc. That's this other simple service is something known as UBR. Okay, as its name indicates, it's unspecified bitrate. Unspecified bitrate is pretty much like what you get in the internet. You can call it, you can rename it and say it's best effort service. Unspecified bitrate is like best effort service. Okay, so unspecified means that there's no a priori guarantee. There's no parameters which are guaranteed a priori. Okay, but you might be forced to not send beyond some peak rate. I think that's the only thing. I mean, so you don't get any privileges a priori. Okay, and when congestion happens, your packets could be dropped, or I mean, cells could be dropped. There's no feedback mechanism and so on. So pretty much like the internet. Okay, the only difference is it's virtual circuit oriented, other than except that internet is connection or connectionless, whereas this is virtual circuit oriented UBR. That's the only difference, and it operates in terms of cells rather than packets. ABR stands for available bit rate, which is an enhancement of UBR, where when congestion happens, the internal switches tell the edge switches or the source switches, as they call an ATM, that there is congestion. Okay, and this could be, the information about congestion could be conveyed either in a single bit, or it could be conveyed in one or two bits, like two or three bits, or it could be also conveyed in a multi-bit field known as an explicit rate feedback. Okay, so I mean, I had the privilege of working in this area during my PhD, and some of our work is part of the ATM standards. And so I can tell you from first-hand experience that this gives you dramatic improvement in terms of what you can do with in terms of congestion control. Okay, so you can do fairly sophisticated congestion control between the edges of an ATM network. Okay, but it turned out that the market did not value that. Okay, you could do fairly fancy congestion control edge to edge, but ultimately performance matters end to end. That is from end TCP connections to TCP connections. Okay, but ABR introduced a lot of new congestion control ideas, which we shall look at. And the other service is called VBR, called variable bitrate, which was developed primarily for video and multimedia applications. Okay, if you talk to the video people or the video compression type folks, they were initially assuming a CBR sort of model for video compression. Okay, and then later they sort of progressed to a VBR model. In other words, if you take an MPEG video today, or if you take, say, a Star Wars movie, right? So if you try to compress it and look at the bitrate, so when there are lots of action, I mean, cruisers going around, etc., right? So that time you will have lots of bits flying around, even in the compressed video. Okay, whereas, I mean, if you're just hanging around and seeing Yoda talking or something like that, so during those periods of time, there are not too many bits. Okay, so so video compression, like MPEG and other standards, naturally leads to a variable bitrate stream. Okay, and if you can provide a service such that this variable bitrate application can fit into this variable bitrate stream, the variable bitrate service, then that will be the best of both worlds, right? So VBR was designed for that. Essentially what it provides is that you can declare your average rate, user can declare and get a guarantee for the average rate, and it can also get some assurances above the average rate to the maximum rate. Remember that in frame relay, above the average rate or the minimum CIR, which we guarantee, all bets are off. Whereas for VBR, you can provide some assurances above that. Okay, and the fourth service which I've left out is GFR, which exactly corresponds to what was provided in frame relay. So frame relay provides a CIR and a PIR, right? So here it's called an MCR, stands for minimum cell rate, and PCR called peak cell rate. So GFR is pretty much like frame relay. It's a frame relay emulation in ATM. Okay, so so essentially CBR is that if I have a voice call that goes through an A2D process and gives a constant bitrate stream, that gets mapped either in a time TDM based carriage system, or it could, this TDM based carriage system could also be mapped to a CBR based carriage system, which is what ATM provides here. And if you have an analog signal like a video signal, which can do not only A2D, that is not only digitize it, but compress it also, then you will get a variable bitrate stream, which could be supported by a variable bitrate service. Okay, and so on the other side, you have not only a D to A process, but also a decompression process. Okay, so that's a simple way of thinking about ATM services. Okay, it looks like, very well thought out, matched all the key applications, audio, video, multimedia, etc. Okay, but what happened in the real world is that CBR became very popular because the voice application already existed. But VBR has dubious popularity because video applications on the net have not taken off yet, okay, or not taken off to a great extent. UBR took off because data, internet traffic could be easily mapped. ABR and VBR sort of stagnated. Okay, but in the process, a lot of interesting ideologies have been developed, and which people like me, who are like transitioning from one world to the other, are bringing back to the IP world or in other contexts. Okay, so anyway, so internally to ATM, some of these classes are also called class A, class B, class C, and class C, class D. Okay, these terminologies are used within a sublayer known as a convergence layer. Okay, it's not a big deal. So just wanted to mention to you. So again, I mentioned the difference between ABR and UBR. One way of thinking about ABR is that when there is congestion, there's a very simple way of thinking about congestion control. One is that if users dump their traffic into the network, okay. So when statistical multiplexing, hits congestion, that is when there's overload situation, this traffic will sit in queues, okay. This traffic will sit in queues more precisely inside the network. Okay, whereas if you use a congestion control algorithm or a feedback-based congestion control algorithm, when congestion occurs, traffic will not sit in queues but will not even enter the network. Okay, so in other words, traffic sits at end systems rather than. So this in operating system lingo or language is known as callback. So in operating systems, you provide a callback to a higher layer and then the application will send some data. So similarly, you can think of this as a distributed callback where the network tells you that there's congestion or not, or network tells you, I have the capacity to accept one more packet, send me. Okay. So the network gives you a callback. Okay. So this is congestion control essentially implements a distributed callback of varying sophistication. Okay. So ABR provides very, very sophisticated callback. Okay. And if you're interested in a case study, I'll be happy to give you a lot of topics. A lot of references in this direction. Okay, so obviously it was developed with some hope that ATM would go ultimately end to end, and then you would have the sophisticated callback reaching all the way to the end systems. But it didn't happen. Okay, so to some extent, it is good for the provider because the internal net switches can have very small buffers. Okay, but buffering has in general become moot over time. Okay, so UBR provides no back pressure. Okay, but what has happened is UBR has become popular because it became easy to provision links rather than manage a complex ABR algorithm. So you can easily throw fibers or multiple wavelengths and to provide lots of core bandwidth. So usually you run UBR over such systems. And I mentioned there's another service called GFR. So it's nothing but UBR plus. You can think of it as just like C plus plus was C plus C and something else, right? So GFR is just UBR plus. It pretty much is like frame relay. Okay, so the language is slightly different. So instead of using CIR, you use a word called MCR or minimum cell rate, and you use the idea of CLP rather than the DE bit. Okay, CLP stands for cell loss priority. So if it is cell loss priority is 1, it means that this packets could be dropped or discard eligible. Okay, very same idea. Okay, so those are the service abstractions which are offered by ATM. Okay, now once you have a service abstraction, Okay. Now, what are the building blocks you need inside the network to implement such a service abstraction? Okay. So, one important building block which a network provides is the routing algorithm. Okay. Now, we saw that IP provides a routing algorithm which allows you to implement a best effort service. Now, ATM provides a sophisticated routing algorithm known as PNNI. Okay. And this is by nature coupled to signaling. Okay. In other words, when signaling comes, it will consult a routing table, okay, to forward the signaling call. Whereas in IP, when a packet shows up, you will refer to an IP forwarding table to forward the packet. So you can think of IP as per packet signaling, okay, or data plane signaling. Whereas here, signaling is clearly control plane, okay. So these words are always overloaded with semantics, but signaling and quality of service routing go hand in hand. And PNNI is again another example of a beautiful ATM protocol, very sophisticated, provides great features, but thoroughly unnecessary. Okay, so ATM connection setup is actually again a very straightforward protocol, but again made complicated because of several features. Okay, so the idea of connection setup is that you want connection setup to be reliable. And the purpose of connection setup is to set up these local identifiers called labels at nodes and maybe do some call admission control to accept the connection, okay, or reserve resources for that connection. So what you do is, for reliable connection setup, you know that whenever you want to do something reliable, you send something and get an acknowledgement, right? So similarly, in connection setup, you will send a setup message and every hop will send back an acknowledgement saying that the call is proceeding, okay? But you can think of this as basically an acknowledgement saying that it has gone some hops, okay, and then you can go further and further till you reach the end system. Okay, now this call setup itself is routed. In other words, how do I know where to go? How do I know where the setup should go to the next? Which is the next hop the setup message should go? Okay, so that answer is given by the routing algorithm, which maintains routing tables, etc., for the call setup to progress. And there are some cool features which I'll talk about, like crank back in the connection setup process. Okay, so you again another brick diagram. Okay, so you see that in ATM you have a control plane which is closely related to a user plane, but it's not sort of mixed. Both of these are separated. And then there's a management plane. Okay, now in IP you only have pretty much a user plane. There is a control plane which is routing, etc., but it is not coupled, or it is not implemented side by side with the data plane. In other words, hosts do not implement routing algorithms. Only routers implement routing algorithms, and it runs in the background. But this diagram essentially says that everybody should implement everything. Okay, and obviously, as you can see, it's a heavyweight implementation. Okay, even though there is some flexibility for choosing and placing functions, you see there's a lot of bricks here, right? So all these functions should be supported. And control plane, you essentially run across names such as PNNI, which is a routing protocol. And then this Q.2931 is just an extension of the earlier Q.931 piece we learned about earlier. It's just a standard signaling protocol, which has the setup message and then acknowledgement, etc. And there's another bunch of names you can ignore. Okay, so it has its own bunch of framing and adaptation layers. As AAL stands for adaptation layer, and whenever you see the words SC or something like that, it usually stands for a convergence sublayer. You have actually a layer here, and then you have sublayers, which are like sort of modular some modular functions there. And AAL stands for adaptation layer. SAAL stands for signaling adaptation layer. Okay. Besides that, you don't have to worry about other things. I mean, pretty much in IP, you have a management plane, which is again decoupled. It runs through the SNMP mechanism, or simple network management protocol. Whereas here you have not only SNMP, but another heavyweight alternative called CMIP. And there is a link management protocol called LMI. Okay, we're not going to study much of this in detail. Just to tell you that it's a fairly heavyweight implementation. And at the base is ATM, which provides a packet or a cell-based virtual circuit transmission, and at the lower layers, or the link layer, you can have Sonnet, etc. ATM can be mapped on a variety of link layers. So again, if I just strip just the control plane and take a look at it, you have Q.931 functionality, which again is helped by PNNI and goes through this entire stack. Okay, and this interface between physical to physical is sometimes known as UNI. So when you study UNI or user network interface, you commonly study either the both the signaling part as well as the data plane parts. So UNI is a common term which is used for both. Okay, so shucks. Okay, let's forget this. Again, this Q.931 is inherited from the earlier versions from telephony, like ISDN used Q.931. Okay, now most of these fields are irrelevant for us from a conceptual standpoint. Essentially, you have some fields which will tell you whether the call is proceeding or you get an acknowledgement, and you have some parameters of it. Okay, that's a simple way to think about it. And these parameters in detail can be held in these things known as information elements. Q.931 is interesting because it's flexible. You can extend it. Suppose today you don't know about a feature, tomorrow you want to add a new feature, you can provide an encoding for that new feature in signaling. Okay, this was very common in telephony because today, originally you had person-to-person calls, and later somebody wanted to have call forwarding or other cool features, like I want to have prepaid calling services, etc. Right? So for this, the signaling part of telephony had to be extended. So the telephone guys were very, very concerned about extensible signaling and to avoid feature interactions, etc. Okay, so as I said, some of the message types which are interesting are, you have the connect and connect acknowledgement, setup acknowledgement, etc. Similarly, you'll have the release side of things. Okay, so you have information elements. Again, don't worry about the details of this field. Usually this such an encoding is known as type length value encoding or TLV encoding. Okay, what these things mean is that it allows you to encode a variable length option or a variable length information element. Okay, so you see that length and contents. Okay, so this is like L and V. Okay, so TLV is a standard protocol terminology which allows for variable length encodings. If you have fixed length encoding, you don't need to say what the length is. Length is obvious. Right? Whereas if you have a variable length encoding, you have to tell what the length is. Okay, that's why the L comes in. And T tells you what is the type. Okay, what is the new, what is the big deal about this new field? Okay, what are you trying to encode? So T tells you what are you encoding. L tells you how long it is, allows you to have variable length stuff. And V tells you what the value of that is so that you can interpret it. Okay, so it allows you to extend protocols with variable length fields. Anyway, so you have the usual type of thing like called party number, called party address, etc. And then you can also have other fancy stuff like quality of service parameters and so on. Okay, so in terms of ATM, right? So we said that I use this Q.931 or a version of that to say that I'm going to encode my call. Okay, now call is proceeding, etc. And then one of the information elements says quality of service. What is the quality of service that is associated with this call? Mm-hmm. Remember that the whole debate about quality of service is one end of the spectrum you have best effort like UBR service. The other end of the spectrum you have something like a telephone line or CBR service or some other intermediate services. You want to tell what's the deal about the service? What is it? What are its parameters, etc. Right? So normally these parameters are specified like leaky bucket parameters, and I think we talked about leaky bucket briefly. We'll look at it again. And so these leaky bucket parameters say that for the CLP 0, okay, that is for the packets which are good, what is going to be the peak rate, okay, what is going to be the sustainable rate, and what is going to be the maximum burst size. Okay, so not only will you get a peak rate, you can only burst at the peak rate for a limited amount of time. That's what maximum burst size says. Okay, and sustainable cell rate is pretty much like average rate or minimum rate within that window. Okay, so this bunch of combinations, right, and 0 plus 1 essentially stands for including the minimum stuff as well as the maximum stuff. Okay, so you can encode your parameters for all services like VBR, CBR, and all these services using some combination of these things. Okay, obviously, simple service like UBR, I mean, there's nothing to encode. Okay, whereas if you want a complex service like VBR, you would encode more stuff. Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to give you the building blocks with which one can specify what a service is. Okay, we don't need to go into great detail. I'll just illustrate some of these ideas soon. Okay, another aspect of signaling is addressing. Okay, if you look at connection-less protocols, one of the biggest things in their headers is the address. Okay, if you look at an Ethernet header, right, It has, let me recall, I think 14 byte header. Okay, but if you look at, it has 6 byte source address and a 6 byte destination address. So 12 bytes or 14 bytes are eaten up just by the address. So similarly, if you look at an IP address, right, it has a 20 byte address, but there is a 4 byte source address and a 4 byte destination address, or 8 bytes out of 20 bytes. Okay, actually smaller ratio, 40% of the address is just, 40% of the header is just address. But this fraction is much more in IPv6, where it uses 16 byte addresses. So it has a 40 byte header, but you have almost 32 bytes of that is just the address. So connectionless protocols is dominated by the address. Okay, in fact, if you look at ATM cell, right, once the connection has been set up, the label, which is actually a form of an address or local address, excuse me, occupies 4 of the 5 bytes. So 5 byte header, 4 bytes label. Okay. So, I mean, just this relative ratio can tell you that address is something important, right? And all of the header information can be so efficiently coded. The address is the one. Why is the address so important? Why can't we code it more efficiently, right? So, this has been a matter that's troubled protocol designers for a long, long time, okay? Especially because at those early days, the link bandwidths were very small and people were trying to squeeze the maximum efficiency out of headers, okay? So, addressing was a big deal, okay? So, in fact, addressing strides were made primarily in telephony. In fact, telephony allows you to have a huge address for signaling. Okay, in fact, ATM uses 20 byte addresses. Okay, so ATM's 20 byte address goes from here to here. Okay, so obviously, I don't show you how it actually says 2 bytes, 10 bytes, 6 bytes, and 1 byte. Right, you add it up, it's 20 bytes. Okay, this is 20 bytes, okay, 20 times 8 bits. Okay, compare this to an IP address which is 4 bytes, okay, or 32 bits. Okay, an IPv6 address is 16 bytes. Okay, so IPv6 is starting to approach ATM addresses in size. But interestingly, you should notice that ATM addresses, even though they're 20 bytes, they don't show up in every cell, right? If you take 20 bytes out of 48 bytes address, I mean, there's going to be nothing less for data, nothing else. So obviously, this address cannot appear in data or in the data plane. So what telephony type protocols do is they usually use a very complex address and complex encodings for the address in the control plane. Signaling carries 20 bytes addresses. In fact, signaling carries sequences of 20 byte addresses to specify a source route. Okay, and this huge address or variable length address or complex to process, etc., is only used in signaling, and that cost of this processing is amortized over the entire lifetime of the connection, right? So, and in the data plane, once the whole thing has been set up, you can afford to use fairly small identifiers, okay? And 32-bit identifiers was just given so that you can have a lot of connections at the same time at the same switch, okay? That is the reason you have 32 bits. Even you don't need really to have 32 bits also, okay? Anyway, so what do I do with large addresses? Why do I need large addresses? First deal with large addresses is, see, an address by definition has to have some global semantic. Okay, all my network nodes should be addressable. What do you mean? It means that they should have some unique global address. Okay, if this address shows up at a router, intermediate router, this router should be able to reference a routing table, and then figure out what to do with this address, where to send this address packet. Okay, next hop. So, in ATM, you do this in the signaling plane, whereas in IP, you do it in every packet, right? So, one important idea of an address, I think it is here somewhere. No, it's not here. I think we covered it when we talked about direct connectivity and indirect connectivity, is that you have address structure. If an address is flat, okay, routers cannot aggregate that address. In other words, routers will have to maintain an entry for every 20 byte quantity. Remember, 20 byte quantity is 2 to the power of 20 multiplied by 8. Okay, so, or 2 to the power of 320. Imagine a router with so many entries. You can't, right, have a router with so many entries. So, what you do is routers typically have much, much fewer entries. Okay, like 10,000 or up to, today IP routers have about 100,000 routes, okay, in its core routers. So that's much far less, okay? 100,000 is like 2 to the power of 20 or something like that. It's not 2 to the power of 320 for sure, okay? So what it means is that you have to keep routing entries only for a prefix of the address, okay? You cannot keep routing entry for the full address, okay? That is the main idea of routing aggregation. So so your route address should provide boundaries, or what are known as address structures or subnet mask, these go by various names, such that I can just keep this prefix and ignore this remaining part, right? So ATM allows you to have a variety of boundaries, okay? Some boundaries can represent countries or international or geographic boundaries, address boundaries. Then within the geographic, you can have organizational boundaries, and within that organization, you can have, I mean, end system indicators or other subnet masked variable length boundaries, okay? So you can also encode a telephone number, also known as an E164 number, directly into an ATM address. You can encode an Ethernet address or a lower level link address directly into an ATM address, so that if I want to do address resolution, which is a common problem in IP, you can directly pull out an Ethernet address out of an ATM address. Okay. So IP also tries, IPv6, if you learn that in internet protocols, it'll also employ similar tricks. So address resolution and address hierarchies are common addressing problems. And ATM, and in fact, a lot of the telephony stack provide you lots of options, perhaps too much choice in handling this. Okay. Now, in addition to just the addressing part, normally what you also provide is a port number in IP. Okay. In IP, you never provide a port number. You provide it at the TCP layer or the UDP layer. You provide a port number like an 8-bit field, which helps you have lots of applications running on top of an IP address or 16-bit field. In ATM, you actually provide the port number, also called a selector, as part of the 20-byte address itself. Okay. Now, obviously, the selector is not used for outing. It's only used for demultiplexing and multiplexing. Okay. So when the selector shows up, I can figure out which protocol this has to go to or which application this has to go to. Okay. So all the stuff can fit into an entire single ATM address. Okay, very compact. Okay, so ATM address hierarchy has all these multiple levels of hierarchy, and you can assign different semantics to these different levels. You can assign addresses in different ways and so on. Countries want to assign addresses in a different way compared to how a single organization wants to manage, or an IT manager wants to manage the addresses within their address space. Excuse me. So lots of levels are possible. You can have actually 104 levels of the hierarchy within this thing. Okay, you can define bit boundaries anywhere. Okay, so recall that the idea of flat addresses, there is no structure. And remember, the structure is when a packet shows up, the structure is used to ask one very simple question. Is the destination directly connected, or is it indirectly connected? If it is directly connected, I can just throw the packet on the net, broadcast on the net, local subnet, and ask the destination to pick it up. Okay, you can think of the network as a bus and throw it. If it is indirectly connected, I have to do more work. I have to find somebody else who will forward the packet. And as a router, I'm forbidden from broadcasting it. Okay, remember, the routers demarcate broadcast domains. So I have to somehow pass the buck, or I have to somehow send the packet to some next hop, okay, which knows what to do, probably. Okay, and the price you pay for hierarchical address is that your routing could be suboptimal in several cases. Okay, so people have given up trying to do routing optimality. Okay, so you'd rather tolerate a few extra hops you gain a lot more from hierarchical addresses. Okay, so getting back to the ATM address formats, I don't know whether you need to know all this stuff. Okay, so I'll just introduce you to some of this language, okay, but you don't need to remember this from an exam perspective, etc. So one half of the ATM address is known as, it has two parts. One is called the initial domain identifier, and then there is an authority and format indicator, or AFI and IDI. And the other part is the domain-specific part. Domain-specific part, as the name indicates, can be managed by the domain, or an autonomous system like RPI, if it had ATM addresses, could allocate it internally. Whereas this stuff is managed by bureaucrats. Okay, that's what it means. Okay, so, and then you have an end system identifier, which could be like an Ethernet address. Okay, it's notice that it has a curious number, 6 bytes, into which a 48-bit is nothing but 6 bytes, right? So Ethernet address can directly be popped in, right? Okay, so, so ATM actually, just like IP addresses, ATM address refers to an interface address. Okay, if you have a computer with multiple interfaces, like say your firewire port or your USB port, okay, each of them you had to give a separate IP address. Okay, suppose you had to Suppose you wanted to actually connect to the internet via these ports. Okay. So similarly, ATM address is also refers to an interface address, and in true ISO style, you have an unreadable acronym for that. Okay. It's called SNPA. Okay. So it's called subnet for point of attachment, another meaningless term. All it means is an interface address. Okay. So, whereas sometimes when you read ATM literature, the addressing or ATM addressing is also known as NSAP address format. NSAP actually in the seven-layer stack refers to network access point, which is sitting on top of the network layer. Okay, so when the ISO originally defined NSAPs and NSAP addressing, it defined a 20-byte address format for defining these NSAP address for defining or addressing these points in the stack. Whereas ATM uses the same encodings or modified encodings to denote lower levels. Okay, so it's just a semantic difference. ATM addresses are pretty much like IP addresses. Okay, they address interfaces. Okay, excuse me. ATM allows you to do varieties of circuits. Okay, you can have permanent circuits, also known as PVCs or permanent virtual circuits, or switched virtual circuit. Remember the word, when you say switched circuit or switched service, it usually means on demand. Like you can call up for a service or you can call up for dial up for a bandwidth. Okay, it means on demand. Okay, switched circuit could be that type. You can provide a point to point circuit or you can provide a point to multi point circuit. Okay, now obviously point to multi point we shall learn later when IP over ATM areas, it had some peculiar uses. Okay, but point to point, multi point, is also meant to support multicast. If I have the same data that like news I want to send it to a lot of my subscribers, I could use a point to multipoint service. Okay, similarly, when you learn IP or internet protocols, you learn about IP multicast protocols that have a similar goal but a completely different philosophy of how to do this. Even this point to multipoint service is signaled. You have to run a signaling protocol to set it up. Excuse me. Okay, and there are some varieties known as leaf initiated join or non-leaf initiated joins, and these are, if you study IP protocol, I'm not going to get into this in detail, are very similar to how IP multicast also works. Okay, by the way, one more thing which is happening is if you're not taking internet protocols right now, or in any case, if you want to refer to internet protocols materials, I'm putting up all the audio files of my earlier class of internet protocols. Last year in spring I taught internet protocols, and I was fortunate to find the files for all of that, the audio files in RSVP, in the PD archives, and Umesh has done me great service to put up all the stuff. So if you want to brush up your basics of CCN or internet protocols, all of this will be online in no time. Okay, so please check it out. I don't know how you guys are using. Did you find the audio stuff to be useful for preparing for the exam? Okay, well, you'll find it useful a few years later when you want to brush up this material, okay? Believe me. Okay, so in terms of the switch model, you can think of the switch as having, again, a few building blocks. Switch reference model is very useful to understand what's going on. There is one plane known as the management interface plane or routing plane. In this plane, right, you exchange what is known as metadata or data that helps you build routing tables. Okay, so a classic example is you exchange topology information like what is my link state, etc., to build a map of the network. Okay, this is known as a topology database. And then you run an algorithm on this topology database like Dijkstra's algorithm. Or in PNNI, you run fairly complex algorithms like quality of service routing algorithms, which are extended versions of Dijkstra or much more complex versions of them. And then what you create from this topology database is some kind of a forwarding table or a routing table that is used by call processing. So when signaling shows up, or UNI signaling shows up here at a router, you want to do call processing, which means you want to do admission control, you have to figure out where to forward this call next. Okay, so for that, you refer to the information that is set up earlier. Okay, and then you can also forward it across boundaries, like you cross the NNI boundary known as network node interface. And after the call has been set up, in other words, the virtual circuit has been set up, you have essentially even another level of forwarding table known as a label table. Okay, so essentially this allows you to do label switching when actual cells show up. So cells have very small addresses are called labels, which are switched. And then after this label switching, you figure out which is the output interface, and then you want to shuttle the cell across the switch from the input interface to the output interface, and this is accomplished by a block known as a switching fabric. Okay, you can think of this like as a multiprocessor, which takes packets and in parallel provides you paths from one interface to the other. Okay, so this is also called a fabric, because fabric is like intertwined, right? So that's, you get parallel paths, that's what it means. It's like multiprocessor that gives you parallel processing functions. Okay, so what else is interesting here? Okay, so call connection setup is fairly straightforward. The basic ideas are very straightforward. You set up, you get an acknowledgement, set up acknowledgement, and so on and so forth, till you go to the end. Okay, but there are some variants of this, and more interesting is how do you find the next hop to go forward, and how do you do call admission control? These are more interesting because simple signaling, basic signaling is trivial. Okay, the signaling becomes complex because you want to do quality of service, and so on and so forth. You don't just want to find a path. You want to find a path that has interesting characteristics and reservations for you. Okay, similarly, connection release is also similar. You send release, you get release complete, and so on. So it proceeds in a hop-by-hop manner. Okay, so PNNI is the protocol which runs between switches. Okay, PNNI has a couple of names. Okay, it can be thought of as network-to-network interface. That is, if I have one ATM network to another ATM network, you can also call it a PNNI. Or if you just have switch-to-switch interface, it's also called PNNI. Okay, now if you consider a routing protocol, right? Routing protocol is something that happens between switches. Switches talk to each other, exchange topology information, etc. So PNNI can be thought of as a simple routing protocol. Its primary function is routing. Okay, so it exchanges enough information to form a map of the network to do routing, but not just ordinary best effort routing. You have to do sophisticated quality of service routing. So it actually builds upon concepts which were developed for best effort routing and specializes them to do interesting quality of service routing. Okay, so we'll now digress into PNNI in particular. If you look at the standards, the first page of PNNI standards, it has this nice summary which says that it's a hierarchical routing mechanism. Okay, and it is not only is hierarchical, it scales for very, very large ATM networks. It allows multiple levels of hierarchy. Okay, now this can be contrasted with IP routing protocols like OSPF, which only provide two levels of the hierarchy. If you look at OSPF routing, it provides hierarchical routing, but only two levels. Okay, but PNNI provides you arbitrary number of levels. And more importantly, it provides, not only it allows you to provide these levels, it allows you to automatically configure these levels. Okay, now this is a more subtle point. In OSPF, if you want to set up multiple levels, you had to actually use manual configuration. ATM, in principle, allows you to do automatic configuration. In other words, nodes can automatically figure out which level they are, and they can elect a leader using distributed leader election protocol, and leaders can talk to other leaders and form another group and elect a leader at a higher level, etc. Okay, so this uses fairly sophisticated distributed coordination algorithms like leader election and so on to form these levels. Okay, so to understand this debate in better context, PNNI came after OSPF, or it was a late entrant after OSPF was developed, etc. So OSPF and ISIS are examples of protocols that provide two levels, and they provide some rudimentary functions at the second level. First level, again, is configured manually, and you configure a leader for that level. Okay, it's known as a border router or an area border router, whereas in PNNI, all is automated. So you can see that automation of areas was a big deal for a while in research circles. Okay, and PNNI solved that problem. In fact, there were some other proposals for IP to solve the problem, but IP just chose not to take them. Okay, so as I mentioned, configuration is a big deal for network managers. It reduces their costs. Okay, so in addition to this, it also provides quality of service routing, which is another feature. So, I mean, lots of worlds are provided in PNNI. PNNI is a fairly sophisticated protocol. So if you go through its feature list, it's quite large. Most importantly, it's hierarchical and it scales. It supports quality of service. All this are pretty much similar. It provides a source routing mechanism. It provides multiple routing metrics or these are known as classes of service. This is known as quality of service. It's dynamic, which means nodes come and go down, no problem. I can route around you. Okay. If you compare this to telephone routing, telephone routing is very simple, right? It is simple because the topology was very expensive. You had to have a full mesh. ATM allows you to do telephone-like stuff, but it gives you flexibility in topology. You can build a much lower-cost topology and still have the sort of industrial strength of telephony style operation. Okay, so some of the terminologies in this are group is an essential idea, or peer group as it's called. Okay, peer group, like you guys are classmates, so you guys are a peer group, right? So similarly, when you have routers at a single level, they are called peer groups. Okay, and the meaning of a peer group is that within a peer group, each node knows every other node, and it knows the link connectivity of that part of that peer group. Okay, which means that, I know the full topology. I have a complete map of that peer group, right? That's what it means. And then when you go to a higher level peer group, you aggregate this information. So to obtain a map, it turns out that you have to shuttle around these link state advertisements. Every link has to figure out what links are, I mean, every node has to figure out what, what links are connected to it. It has to identify link attributes like what is bandwidth, what's the residual bandwidth, etc. for quality of service routing, and then create what is known as a link state advertisement, which by, as the name indicates, you advertise it to everybody else. Everybody else means everybody else in the peer group. So which means you have to essentially flood this information or broadcast it. Okay, remember when I use the word broadcast, it's inefficient, right? So you don't want to broadcast things everywhere. So the peer group boundary provides filtering for broadcasts. You don't propagate broadcasts beyond peer group boundaries. Now here the broadcast refers to broadcast of control information, not broadcast of data packets. Remember in data packets, the router is the thing which demarcates broadcast domains. Here you can have routers broadcasting to each other, but we are talking about a peer group which demarcates a set of routers or a set of switches, which and broadcasts off these peer group messages. Don't go beyond that, or what are known as link state advertisements. Okay, now, so that is a similar idea. You see, filtering is a very common theme in networking. Okay, now border node obviously is something that has privilege of taking a summarized peer group information. Like, it takes the entire peer group, even though it's a network of nodes, and then collapses them into one virtual node. Okay, so to the outside world, it makes it seem as though this whole network is actually a single virtual node, which has its own address. Okay, and that address, interestingly, is an aggregated address, or is just a prefix of the original address. Okay, so that is why you have the restriction that all nodes within a peer group should share the same prefix, so that you can figure out what the prefix is. And normally in OSPF, you have to manually configure this information, whereas PNNI can figure it out automatically. Okay, so it's auto-configured. So you can each peer group leader not only can elect itself automatically, okay, it can also summarize automatically and send that summary information across to the next higher level of peer groups. Question?
What's the difference between a peer group and a subnet then, as far as the addressing?
Okay, the question was, what is the difference between a peer group and a subnet? Okay, so normally a single switch could service a subnet, okay, and then it aggregates that subnet and provides a prefix. A peer group aggregates a set of subnets, so it's a higher level aggregate, if you may. Okay, so you can take this analogy back to IP routing, where in IP you have a single subnet, okay, and a router serves that and demarcates that. And you have a bunch of routers that operate as OSPF, as say an area, right? And you have a super subnet, let's say. Okay, so it's a bigger subnet, but it's not really a subnet. Usually refers to somewhere you can broadcast, okay, broadcast data. So here you have an aggregated address or a smaller prefix, which you create at an area level and send it to a higher area, and then you can aggregate this whole thing into a single autonomous system, and an autonomous system can send one aggregate to other autonomous systems. So you see, you have a hierarchy of boundaries, and across these boundaries, you typically advertise smaller prefixes. So the only difference in semantics is that the similarity is that you advertise aggregates and smaller aggregates, Whereas the difference is that a subnet, by definition, you can broadcast. Whereas in a peer group, you cannot broadcast data, but you can broadcast control messages. In other words, you can flood control messages. Okay, so that's the difference. Answer your question? Okay. Okay, so since peer groups are organized hierarchically, you, in a hierarchy like a tree, you have parents and child, right? So, or parents and children. So you have a notion of a parent node and a child node. And any node is typically called, instead of just calling it a node, you call it a logical node, okay? Because a node can be at a higher level in the peer group hierarchy, right? So it's not really a single node, it's a logical node. Okay, and a peer group leader is what you expect. I mean, it's somebody who, it's a node which has the capability to aggregate routing information. Okay, and peer groups are given IDs. And IDs, it turns out, okay, one interesting aspect about peer group IDs are that in OSPF, there is something known as an area ID, or if you consider an autonomous system, there is something known as an autonomous system number. Okay, these are separate IDs, okay? In other words, these IDs are not encoded into an IP address. If you recall that a network address is actually encoded into an IP address. An IP address is a dual address. It not only tells you what is the interface address, it also tells you which is the network this fellow is sitting on, okay, this interface is sitting on. Whereas it does not tell you which area it does not tell you in a global sense or global meaning which area is this interface sitting on. Whereas in PNI, it tells you that. The peer group ID is actually an aggregated form of the address. Okay, by looking at a node and says that, okay, this is the peer group ID, it also tells you that a node is sitting in this address. It has this interface address, it has this peer group, it also has, it also is a member of multiple peer groups at various levels. Okay, if you just knew how many bits to mask off, you'd know exactly which peer group it lies in. Okay, so this address, so you have the equivalent of an autonomous system or an area identifier, which is not encoded in an IP address, in ATM is encoded. Okay, you have all this information latent in the ATM address. Okay. Okay, so what does it look pictorially? Okay, and pictorially, you can have a bunch of nodes. Okay, so normal nodes, and you see that these nodes have addresses which look hierarchical. You have this dot representation. Okay. Just for convenience, you can think of when I look at this this address, if I knew where this dot appears, okay, I can tell you that this node is a single node. It has an interface ID of A.1.2. I can also tell you that this node lies in peer group A.1. I can also tell you that this node A.1.2 lies in peer group A, okay, because that is a suffix, that's a prefix of this address itself. So you're encoding all of that in this notation. Okay, now here let's look at this. This PG of AF1 says that this is a peer group A.1. There is a leader here, which is indicated in black. Okay, this leader is not magically come. I mean, if the leader dies, another leader will be elected. Okay, now if you study distributed processing, distributed algorithms, etc., in computer science, one of the algorithms you learn there is what is known as leader election. Okay, this is also a common thing in fault tolerance. If a fault occurs and the leader dies, you need another leader, right? So there's an election algorithm which floats around. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details of this election algorithm, but just assume that there is a fully distributed way of figuring out who's going to be the leader. Okay, so, and A.1.3 has been elected as a leader. And so this is basically your representative in the higher level. Okay, so similarly, just like we elect Congress leaders and congressional representatives and whatever, right? So these leaders show up at the higher level of the hierarchy. So now these black fellows, okay, are essentially organized at a higher level. Okay, and that higher level organization is known as a peer group A. Okay, so you have a super organization here known as peer group A, and then that can be aggregated. And when you want to talk to a node which is in peer group B, you don't have to tell this node outside any of the details of your topology. You can just tell this whole thing is a single node, just send packets to me and I'll forward packets for you, okay, to any node in peer group A. Okay, so internally I'll have visibility to a limited amount of topology information at higher levels. Okay, I think there's another diagram. Yeah, here's the beautiful diagram. Okay, so the same diagram, right? if you understand it at a higher level, right, you can think of there's another network, a logical network at the higher level, which has connectivity like this. A.1, which is this peer group, is connected to another peer group. Notice that this peer group looks like a single node. Okay, this is why we call it a logical or virtual node, which is A.4 and A.2, and this is the connectivity between them. Connectivity between higher level nodes exists if there is some connectivity between lower level nodes. Okay, so now this peer group, this bigger peer group is known as peer group A, which is obviously connected to peer group B. Okay, so now why am I doing all this stuff? Okay, it helps me aggregate link state information, or essentially I can look at each node can have different degrees of visibility into how the network looks like. Or in other words, I want to get an idea of the map of the network. I mean, and it's too expensive for me to get a map of the whole network because of shuttling all these link state advertisements. I can get partial maps. Okay, if I'm a sort of ordinary citizen here, I can get a map of this network, and I can choose how a route, my own route, to reach a peer group leader. If I'm a peer group leader, I not only know this map, but I also know this map. Okay, I'm special. Okay, so now if I'm a peer group leader of this, I not only know this map and this map, I also know the connectivity across these higher level peer groups. Okay, so with this, you can do some interesting routing. Okay, so let's look at hierarchical routing. So if I look at A.1.1's view of the entire network, A.1.1 knows that it knows the complete topology of this, and it knows that all the stuff is connected to A.2, and beyond this, it has no visibility. It just knows that A.2 is connected to B, and it's connected to C. How does it know this? A summary advertisement from the peer group leader of this C is sent to B, and then B relays that summary advertisement to A.2, etc., which is relayed inside. So summary advertisements from other peer group aggregates are flooded within the peer group as well. So peer group knows complete topology internally and some sense of the topology outside. Yeah.
To A.4.5, does it have to go up through like the peer group to the next level to A.2 and then come back?
Okay, it's a very good question. Can we defer that? I'm going to show you how explicit routing occurs, okay, in just a couple of slides. So the question, by the way, for remote students is that how does A.1.1 figure out the route to A.4.5? Okay, it's a good question, okay. And in fact, not only do you want to just figure out any common route, or any best effort route, you might want to have a route that has particular attributes, like particular quality of service capabilities. So that's an even additional challenge, right? Okay, so in addition to just having the map of the network, you not only have a map, but you also have an annotated map. If you buy a map from AAA, right, today, or you get a map of driving map, right, you also have other information, like are there any mountains around here, are there any sort of fields around here, and so on, right? So essentially here, it will tell you more information. There's no mountains and fields in networks, right? So there you have, each link has interesting information, like what is the capacity of the link, what is the delay of the link, or what is the how much reservations are already there in the link, etc. So all this stuff is characterized as what are known as link attributes, okay, or just fancily known as link state. Okay, that's why it's called link state protocols. You whenever you want to send some information about your link, you call it a link state and then throw it around. Okay, and you can have metrics, etc. And these, we shall see, are used for quality of service routing. Okay, now, essentially what happens is once you have figured out what route you want to go in, at every hop in the route, you run what is known as call admission control to see, okay, here's a route. So essentially here's what happens. Once I have a map of the network, right, I can chart a route through the network, okay, to reach the destination. Okay, I'll tell you how to chart that route in a moment. But once you chart in this route, this specification is known as a source route. Okay, and this method of routing is known as source routing. Okay, source routing means that the source specifies the route. That's all it means. Okay, so first thing you should understand is that this is very different from IP. Okay, in IP, source does not mention the route. There is an option in IP known as loose source routing. The source can specify a loose route or a partial route. Whereas, I mean, it's not used very often. Okay, and in fact, routers don't support it also sometimes. Internet, what happens is that the routers take on the responsibility to provide best effort routes, and the source doesn't specify a route. Whereas in PNI, the source will have a view of the entire network topology in some aggregated format. It'll somehow figure out that I want to go this particular route, Okay, and it will make the decision. The primary reason you use source routing is once I have enough information about the network, not only its connectivity but also its attributes, then I can guess, okay, which route is likely to have the quality of service that I want. Okay, so it can run a local algorithm to try to figure out which route is likely to have it. Okay, just because it's likely to have it doesn't mean it will have it, because there is some delay between when the linked state advertisements are shuttled around and when I'm trying to make a decision, when I have a new call trying to show up. Okay, when a new call shows up, I need to route this call, right? So I make a good faith estimate of, like real estate brokers give you, right? A good faith estimate of which route I want. And then I call this route a source route, put it in a PNNI header, okay, and send it along with the signaling packet. Okay, now signaling packets carry the source route. That's why it carries a sequence of router IDs, okay? In this case, it's 20 byte globally known. So you have a huge sequence, okay? It has 20 byte headers, 20 byte addresses, a sequence of them, and it goes through the network, and at every router, it goes and asks, do you have resources? Okay, if you do, please reserve, and I'm going to go forward, okay? And then at the moment you reserve the resources, you send back an acknowledgement saying, oh, I've gone past this router. Okay, and then you might hit a router which does not have resources. Okay, if all is well, your estimate was correct and you get a route all the way from source to destination and all resources are reserved and the signaling is set up. Okay, but if sometimes you might hit a router that does not have resources, your estimate was either wrong or probably too many things happened in between. So PNNI allows you to, a simple feature of allowing you to crank back, you go back to the previous router and try to find another path from there. Okay, the previous router then reinitializes the source route and you try another route, okay, across the network. So this is known as crankback, okay. So it is very sophisticated because telephony originally did not have all this crankback business. Telephony, you just try a few alternate routes. I look at a table and try 1, 2, 3, 4. If all these routes are not there, your phone call is dropped, okay. Okay, your call is blocked, okay. Whereas in ATM, you can try some very fancy things. Okay, so, I mean, the idea is that if you're running over an ATM network, the call blocking probability will be extremely low, you know, even for sophisticated services like CBR and VBR and all these other services. Okay, so this call admission control is basically answers a simple question. Do I have resources? If so, set up the state for the resources. Okay, so this is, it's broken up into two parts. One is a logical idea called generic call admission control, and then there is an actual call admission control. Okay, we'll study this in a little more detail. Okay, so as I said, the source actually sets up, figures out what route it wants. It has the entire map, and it charts a route, okay, and the route is actually encoded in the following format. I want to go to this destination, and I have a sequence of 20 byte addresses, 1, 2, 4, 5. So I want to go on this route 1, 2, 4, 5 to destination. So D is over here, and then 1, 2, 4, 5 is here. Okay, don't be fooled by the small size. Each of those 20 bytes, okay, huge addresses. And then what is interesting is this is encoded as a data structure called DTL or designated transit list. Okay, now this will start answering your question of how I will find a route. Okay, now suppose I have a node A.1.1, okay, and I want to reach B.3, okay. It's somewhere in a different peer group, okay, and also in a different peer group aggregate. I don't know the full topology from source to destination. How can I find an entire route if I don't have full topology? So what I'll do is I'll make my best guess. In other words, I'll find a route, okay, that's to a good approximation. So here's what the route looks like. And I'll encode the route in a form called, this looks like a stack pretty much, okay. So essentially what this tells me is this. From A.1, I order the signaling call to go to A.1.2. A.1.1, I order it to go to A.1.2. And then essentially you are going to leave the domain A.1, or sorry, the peer group A.1, and I order you to go to the peer group A.2. That's what this means. And then I know that you're going to leave the peer group A itself, and I order you to go to peer group B. Okay? This is as much as I can tell you, because I know for sure that B.3, okay, by its very structure, I know it is located in peer group B. So I'm just specifying a route, but it is explicit route. Okay? I am specifying it at the source and explicitly. Okay, there's no implicit notion. Implicit means like an IP, some route is formed for you. I mean, you have no clue what the route is. But here you explicitly specify the route at the source as much as you can. Okay, now when this signaling packet obediently follows this route and shows up at A.1.2, what happens is that the top part is popped out of this designated transit list. Okay, that's why you see this thing become smaller. And then this new designated transit list so far, which has this remaining stuff, is passed to the entry router in the next peer group, A.2. So A.2, actually, this router is actually called A.2.1, is the peer group leader of A.2. So what it does is then it decides that it wants to transit this peer group in the following manner. It forms a partial route across this peer group. Okay, and that partial route, in this case, you could have a route either which goes this two-hop path or this one-hop path. In this case, it tries this one-hop path, which says that from A.2.1, I go to A.2.3. Okay, if I had a three-hop path, I would have three entries here, right? So this is basically pushed onto this transit list. Okay, you can think of it as a stack data structure. And when I it's again a command. Okay, you forward this packet partially up to here. And then here again, you pop the remaining stuff, that is A.2.1, A.2.3. And you notice that you pop two levels of the stack. Okay, it's because I'm going to now not only leave peer group A.2, but I'm also going to leave peer group A. So I pop this two sub-levels. And then this small stack or the remaining DTL is given to the node at the entry of peer group B. Okay, now peer group B decides that I want to take a three-hop path going from B.1 to B.2 to B.3. So it explicitly specifies that here. And then as it goes to this router, you will then forward it further. Okay, and until you have actually reached the destination, you will not pop this entire thing out. Okay, so the destination can actually retrace and know that, oh, by the way, this signaling call came from B.2 and from B.1. The reason you know this information is because if I want to crank back, suppose I come show up at B.3 or B.2 or, I mean, say B.3, and I don't have resources, right? I want to crank back. So I can actually use this information to figure out where to crank back. Okay, crank the signaling call back. Okay. So this is, and at the end, once you reach the destination, which happens to be B.3 in this case, the entire DTL or the entire stack is flushed. Okay. So what is this? This is essentially an explicit source route where within my limits of visibility into the network, I can specify a route. Okay. With the implicit understanding that B.3 lies in peer group B. And then I have other agents on my path, which again specify explicit routes for the remaining portions. And it goes, the call progresses through the network, and you can have it done. Okay. So when we study traffic engineering, okay, this is actually a fairly sophisticated form of routing. Okay. So it allows you, suppose I know that the resources exist in this path, I can send packets and all that. So one might be, an interesting question is, can I do something similar without signaling? Can I do something like this in a connectionless manner? Okay. So it turns out that at RPI, we've actually come up with a method to do something very similar in a connectionless manner. Okay. And we'll study those ideas later when we study traffic engineering. Okay. But essentially, this is how source routing is done. This is how source routing using aggregated topologies is done. And this is how source routing is, and even though it's called a designated transit list, it's